Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Jersey Coastal Live. I'm Andrea Tarr. Well, today we're talking about one of our favorite topics on Jersey Coastal Live, and that's food. And who doesn't like to talk about food? But even better, talking about food is talking to people who are very much into the culinary world. And my guest today is Tracy Seaman. And she's
Hi, Andrea. How are you doing today?
I am so good, and Tracy, thank you for being with me. You've got an amazing culinary career, and you've been, let's see, just to name a few of Tracy's accomplishments, and I mean just a few, let's see, she is a cookbook author, a freelance recipe developer, a food stylist, a writer, consultant, a culinary instructor, a test kitchen associate for Food & Wine magazine, test kitchen director for Every Day with Rachel Ray, and a restaurant reviewer. So I feel like you've touched on just about all the good jobs in the world of food.
I think I worked everywhere but Bon Appetit, pretty much.
What happened with that?
they were in California most of the time, and I was in New York. And
oh,
they came
okay.
to New York, and actually I did interview there, but just the timing wasn't good, and
mm-hmm.
I probably wanted a ton of money, but I figured if I was going to go there, I wanted a ton of money.
Yeah, well, to move to California to work for them, sure. But meanwhile, you have definitely had an amazing food experience, and you've done a lot. And first of all, I want to backtrack a little bit, like I generally do with my guests, because you told me that you really started cooking when you were about 5 years old, and you were cooking with your dad. So
right.
Tell me about that. What did you cook
together?
I don't know
if my interest first started because of my mom. I was one of five kids. I have three older brothers and a younger sister. And my mom made dinner every night. You know, this was in the 60s. It was
That's what mom said.
We had
yep.
We lived in a farmhouse that was really cool. It wasn't fancy or anything. But my mother's mother was a great cook. And my mom was a great cook. She wasn't all into herbs and spices. She was like, I considered her sort of, well, looking back, she was like a salt and pepper cook, but she always got quality ingredients, and she made dinner every night, and I would sit on the counter and watch her cook. I think I was fascinated with the process. And then my
mm-hmm.
dad made breakfast on Sundays and Saturdays too, but on Sunday we go to church, and then we come home and we just make a big batch of scrambled eggs, and I guess I probably said I want to do it, and he pulled over a chair. I got up on the chair, and that's where it all began.
Scrambled eggs.
Yep.
Well, you know, very, very typically when I talk to someone from the world of food, there is usually a grandma in the picture that was very influential, who was a great cook, and so obviously that was the case with you as well. So your mom
right.
and your grandmother were the big family cooks.
Right.
Yeah.
I never met her, though. She died pretty young. She died in her early 50s. And so I heard stories about
mm-hmm.
During the Depression, they had a farm, and they raised turkeys, actually. My grandfather was a stockbroker, though, but they had a farm in Colts Neck on 537. And they raised turkeys, and my grandmother had a huge garden, and my mother would help actually pluck the turkeys. So I'm really sorry I never met my grandmother, because I'm sure she had have different viewpoints of the stories that I know about my mom, you know?
Yes, yes.
So
for you, it started cooking with your dad with some scrambled eggs. And
mm-hmm.
so what are some of your other early family food memories? Did you have big family dinners together?
Well, we did when since I had three older brothers, and they got girlfriends, and then they had, got married. They got married younger than I did, and so there were, more and more people around, and everyone came to our house all the time. So holidays got bigger and bigger, and then we'd prepare everything. You know, nowadays, like, if I have to make a holiday meal, I have to do a lot of stuff ahead, but we would
mm-hmm.
maybe do the desserts ahead, and we just did everything. We would start earlier in the day, and we'd have dinner maybe at 5 o'clock, but we were all giving a hand. It was really nice. So it was a great holiday memory for me for a long time. And then,
mm-hmm.
things changed later on, but that's what I always strive for. Like, I would love it if people would come over and help me make a holiday meal, because a lot of times I end up doing a lot of the work on my own. So I don't have big dinners anymore. My family's kind of spread around, and we take turns going to people's houses, each other's houses a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have, we used to have like 26, 28 people. A couple of aunts and uncles would come. So,
that's
yeah, it was
crowd.
Great.
Yeah,
it was
that's
great.
Those are great memories. That's
My dad
I
did all
that.
The
that's
dishes.
Very nice.
I wish
oh,
I had my
him.
Dad still to do the dishes.
Good for him. So did you imagine that you might actually have a culinary career? Did you have any ambitions in that direction?
Well, I did. I think when I was unfortunately, at the time when I was in high school, the guidance counselors weren't gearing a lot of people towards certain things. Everything was liberal arts or business school, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think if I had gotten different guidance, I would have gone, you know, to a hospitality program or something like that. But I always kind of liked the idea of working for a food magazine. And I was a pretty good writer. I liked poetry and literature, especially. So when I finally went to school, and all my siblings went to business school, and I thought, ugh, I can't go to business school. It's unfortunate. I wish I had taken some business courses. But so I ended up majoring in English in writing. And then I realized afterwards, the thought of going to a two-year culinary school after that was just sort of like, oh, I don't want to go to any more school. So I did take
yeah.
a break, and
yeah.
I did a few odds and ends and traveled a little bit, but I had interviewed, and back then you'd have to start as someone's secretary, and my typing wasn't fast enough or good enough, but I had my eye on gourmet especially, and it's like trying to break into jail. I just couldn't get there, and I ended up, a friend of mine saw an article in a magazine. It was a trade
mm-hmm.
publication, because she was in the advertising agency, and she saw an article about this place called the New York Restaurant School, and she said, I found the thing for you, because, like I said, going to CIA was 2 years more, and I just had enough of going to a college environment and going
mm-hmm.
to school. So this was right in Manhattan, and I took the train, and it was about an eight-month course. They were affiliated with the new school. They ended up being bought out, and then they don't exist anymore, but it was a great experience. It was really small and like an intimate school setting. We had management in the morning and hands-on cooking in the afternoon, and it was
mm-hmm.
great. And so then I was able to kind of make
yeah.
a shift. And at that same time, a lot of the women's service magazines wanted people to be home economists, which I wasn't. So that was frustrating for me, too, because when I tried to apply to those places, they didn't want to talk to me because even though I had a college degree, it wasn't the one that they wanted. So
but let me ask you a question. So what does that even mean, a home economist? Because I can remember, when I was
know,
in
they
high
don't
school,
exist anymore.
And, yeah, there was home ec. All girls
right.
took home ec. And, we baked cookies or something. But what does that mean, a home economist?
Well, I guess in a home ec degree, I never asked the real particulars. I always had this vision of a home economist opening a can of prepared cherry filling and dumping it in a crust and doing it for a low price. I guess part of it was to be frugal, keeping an eye on expenses, but there was nutrition involved. And some,
mm-hmm.
I think maybe some home economists became dietitians in hospitals and things like that, but they weren't really known for their culinary genius.
No,
no,
absolutely
not. So, and that
not.
that sort of disappeared at some point, which kind of isn't funny to me really. But and now people major in food science, and I think that's what that evolved into.
So you were looking to work on your culinary genius.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no,
and then
I
had several years after college, and even after culinary school. After I graduated, I took a food styling class, and that was for a number of weeks. And I ended up working for a couple of the stylists as an assistant. So, and the assistant like chops the onions and washes
mm-hmm.
the dishes, and tears up sheets of paper towel and stuff like that. Like things, and then so I would prep things, cut things into particular pieces, and give them, you know, keep the food stylist, keep her going by preparing some of the ingredients and then clean up afterwards.
So explain for people who might not understand, so what is a food stylist? Because we've seen evidence of their work, even though we might not really know what it means.
Well, and just like any art form, food styling has changed mm-hmm. over the years. So a food stylist, when I was starting, you could be a stylist for editorial for a magazine, or you could be a stylist for advertising, which was a lot more lucrative, but you had to, in order to do that, I think a lot of the people started in editorial and worked their way around magazines. It was also typically a freelance career, so mm-hmm. you would get hired by the job. My same friend who worked for an advertising agency, she had one of her accounts was Orange Crush. And the food stylist, and this was for commercials, the food stylist had to cut these spiral orange peels. And so a hand model would, like, pull on the orange, and the peel would come off, and they would do, you know, magic through photography. But
yeah.
they probably had cases and cases of oranges and had to do a lot of prep for that.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, the food styling was geared toward very neat and clean and very perfect looking. And nowadays, it's much more natural, crumbs on the plate, pepper on the
yes.
plate,
yes.
you know, smears on the plate. I'd rather see a pie that's three quarters eaten, you know, with one nice piece left in it than a whole pie. Personally, you know, it sort of brings you in. So the difference between styling for editorial and styling for advertising is it's like a whole different thing, even though it involves a lot of the same practices. Nowadays, there's no – people would say, oh, do you put shellac on things? And there was really nothing like that, but sometimes you would use maybe corn syrup in a gravy to keep a skin from forming, or you would put a little something to make a sauce darker. We used to have this gravy master stuff and some other things. But now the photography is so quick, you don't have to really worry about your sauce sitting too long because with digital photography it's different. Back then they would take Polaroids and get things exactly how they wanted them. Sometimes
okay.
there would be a stand-in dish. So you'd arrange the dish, and then you'd have the beauty, or you just throw, like, a couple of pieces of something on a plate, and the photographer could set up on the plate, and then you'd be working on your beauty. You know, there might be two of the same exact pieces of china, and you'd be working on the good one, and you'd swap it. And then they'd be taking a Polaroid, and then someone would say, oh, turn the plate a little, or we need a little more parsley
mm-hmm.
in that little crevice, or there's a dark spot, we have to... You know, there was a lot of tinkering, but now they take a lot more photos, a lot more tries, a lot more dishes. And in some ways, it's a lot harder because the food stylist and the teams and the props, and there's prop stylists, too, who
mm-hmm.
take all the props for these shoots. It's a lot more challenging because the volume is more. Before, it was much more tedious, I guess, is the best way to say it.
Well, is it fair to say that every photo we see in every magazine and everything we see on TV has been touched by a food stylist? Nothing is random.
Yes, probably. And there's more people behind the scenes than you really think. You know, if a person
yes.
has a show, I don't want to mention any names, if a person
mm-hmm.
has a show, they have a team of people that are testing their recipes and prepping their ingredients and, you know, helping them tinker with things so that things come out the best that they can.
Because it has to look good for TV? Is that
right.
a big part
also,
of it?
And also, the other part of it is the recipe itself. You know, it's so funny nowadays, if you read a recipe online for Epicurious, let's say, and
yeah.
then let's say the recipe gets 3.5 forks, and there's a million different comments from
uh-huh.
the members of the site. And they'll say, oh, I really like this, but I added lemon zest and garlic to it, and it completely changed the dish, which is pretty funny. And the thing that's crazy to me is somebody actually worked really hard to get the dish that way, and there were people that were tasting it and testing it, and a lot of recipes, especially in the magazines, I found this to be true. I think the websites are a lot more fast-paced, and they are not so strict about how things are done. They're a little bit more casual and don't care if people want to do this or that to a recipe. But we used to go through painstaking processes to get the recipe so that it would work out for everyone who made it, especially baking dishes.
So that's an interesting thing. Well, first of all, I have to agree with you. You do see, I look at Epicurious and lots of other websites with recipes, and you see a recipe, and then you see the comments. And I'm going to say I always feel like more than half of the comments are how people have modified the recipe. So I do find that kind of an interesting little thing. But I guess you're the person to ask, so how are these recipes developed in the first place? And, I mean, does it just come up with an idea that somebody says, well, what can we do different with salmon? Or how can we just, you know, create the perfect cherry pie? And then you're given a task to put something together?
Well, it's different in different places. I did a freelance stint at Martha Stewart Living for a while, which I really loved it there because I was like a one-man band. Some people would work. There'd be like a staff member who would be given a junior person to help them. But I would fill in for someone on maternity leave, and I did everything by myself. But I liked it because I would work on a project from start to finish, which I did in a lot of the places where I was on staff or not. And what do I want to say about that? I don't know where I was going with that, actually.
That's okay.
But I know I liked it there. Well, I don't know. We'll start talking again, and I'll remember what I was going to say.
Yeah. So somebody wants to develop a recipe, whether it's for a magazine, you know, it's fall. We're looking for new fall recipes. So how does that come together?
Okay. Well, now I can remember what I wanted to say about Martha Stewart Living. Okay. Let's say The magazine was around for 15 years, and they wanted to have I did a chili menu for a little entertainment story. Now, the chili couldn't be like any other chili they had before, and the cornbread couldn't be like any other cornbread they had before. And that was actually a really good rule because if you had something that's good, they didn't want to reprint the same thing. So that was one of their particular criterias. I remember the cornbread that I did with this chili menu was a brown sugar cornbread, and I can't remember what else it had in it, but it wasn't like any other one that they did, or they wouldn't have let me do it. I worked at Food and Wine, and then I worked at several magazines after that kind of had similar ways that we did things. We would have a calendar that projected out across the year. Like, let's say we would meet in April, and we would plan by the time it was April, let's say you're working 6 months ahead. I was at the beginning of the cycle because the test kitchen would do the recipes, and then they would go through maybe like 3 months of an editorial cycle after we would give them to the editors. So we would want to start thinking about what we were going to do 6 months ahead. April, we would be starting to really work on Halloween.
Okay.
So we would know in April kind of what we were doing in September for back to school stuff and things like that. So in April, we would do a general planning calendar for the following year, starting in January, all the way through the next year. So we'd be like a year and a half ahead. And then as things were scheduled, let's say for January we had a Super Bowl thing or something like that, or maybe something weirder than that, not as typical. I would say, oh, look, this particular party is on the calendar. Let's say it was a movie night party and you invited friends over. I would say, okay, I want to do this kind of stew and blah, 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 and this kind of salad. And how does that sound? Like I would write a memo to somebody, or I would meet with somebody and they would say, oh, that sounds good, or, oh, we don't want to do a stew because we have this other story that's a Russian stew and we want to do something else for this entertaining thing. So that's how the things kind of began. And a lot of times freelancers would develop on the outside and then we'd get things on the inside. And it was funny because sometimes we would have developers on the outside who would kind of do a skeletal version of a dish or a menu, and they thought, you know, and then if you were going to change anything as a courtesy, you would go back to the author and say, you know, this cake really didn't rise right. And sometimes people would say, oh, well, that's the test kitchen's job to work it out. I was just giving you a base recipe, but we really wanted recipes that worked. So everything, you know, I can't speak for now, but I could say that magazines like Good Housekeeping and Food and Wine still, and a lot of the ones that are well-established, they test all their recipes at least one time. And sometimes we would test things three times if we couldn't get it right. Sometimes we would go back to the author and say, this is just not working. Will you please rework it? And then we would talk back and forth to come out with a solution. And sometimes we had to just totally revamp stuff. You know, so it wasn't just like, I used to think that my mother thought I was just going into New York to have lunch every day or something.
Right.
Like she didn't really understand
just to cook.
That it was
more
than just whipping up stuff. You know.
Well, are you ever charged with the idea that, okay, I want you to come up with recipes that we're using more cumin or Moroccan spices, or, you know, that somebody wants you to use particular ingredients and now you have to develop something that uses those ingredients?
Yeah, that would happen. There were also stories that were single ingredient, like chicken stories were really popular. So there was one time that two of my associates at Food and Wine and I, they said we want, I don't know if it was a dozen chicken recipes or 20 chicken recipes. So we had to research and we would look at books. The big magazines would have cookbook libraries that you would be able to check out a book, actually sign out a book and look at it. And then it's a frightening supply of cookbooks I have in my own house, and I keep looking at them, and I have them in three different rooms, and I think I got to get rid of some of these, you know, because some of them I don't really look at that much, but I have cookbooks that focus on all kinds of different cuisines all over the world. And it used to be that something from a remote part of, oh, I don't know, Iceland, let's say, was really strange and different, and now it wouldn't be so crazy. I don't mean to say it wouldn't be special, but it's a lot. Everything's gotten so global that
even
people
our ingredients
are
and our food.
Know a lot more about ingredients and know a lot more about foods, and there's all kinds of restaurants that are, if you go to Jersey City, there's probably 76 kinds of ethnic restaurants that aren't repeats, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
So,
but now, what have you noticed over time, how are our tastes changing in the kitchen, our culinary, you know, what falls out of favor, what's on trend that you've really noticed?
Well, I think a lot of people are more familiar with a lot of different spices. A lot of people are worried about their health, even if they don't act like they are. They say that they are.
They are.
And I think in their minds they are. Gluten-free and dairy-free is a big thing now, but I think that has benefits for a lot of people. Because of industrialized farming, some of our farmed goods, especially the wheat, they become compromised from being farmed quickly, and the products have changed. Some people can go to Italy or France and have all the bread they want, and they feel fine. They come home, and they don't feel well.
Yeah. Well, I think many people would say that our food supply is somewhat compromised from 50 years ago, 25, 100
yeah.
years ago. So
yeah.
Everything's
so fast. That's the thing. Everything's mm-hmm. been raised quickly, and it's sort of like it's because things aren't done. I guess the best way to say is by hand. You know, when things are done by hand, they just seem to be better. When everything is really mechanical and it feels like there's a lot, to me, it makes me think that there's a lot of heat involved in the process, you know, instead of a light touch or and another thing that is really important for any cooking that just came to my mind is half of what the outcome is created by the intention
Hello?
Of the person making it. Are you there? Did I lose you? Hello?
Oh,
did
Tracy,
you lose me?
Are you still with me?
I'm here. I can hear you. I can hear you. I can hear you.
Well, I don't know if I lost
Hello?
Tracy or if my listeners are still out there. And for that, I must apologize. I don't know what happened. So, unfortunately, my guest today, Tracy Seaman, I'm going to have to, wait a second, looks like I got her back. Tracy?
I just called you. Hello, can you hear me? Can you
okay.
hear me?
I don't know what happened. So forgive me, audience, I don't know what happened to my call with my guest today, Tracy, but with any luck, I'll have an opportunity to get her back as a repeat guest, and we'll be able to finish up. We were just moments away, actually, from ending, so my apologies to everyone. So 30 minutes can change your life, so please keep listening to Jersey Coastal Live. Till next time, I'm Andrea Tarr, and we've been doing this show now for about 5 years, and I'm very appreciative to all of my listeners. Thanks for being with me today. Bye, everyone.